Hello and welcome to Sliding Into the DMs. This is a D&D meta podcast to help you DM your campaign. Although you're probably going to wind up listening to it because we're probably going to get into dumb arguments and you're going to, you know, use it as a self-esteem boost because at least you aren't as pathetic as we are. I'm your host, Anthony, and with me are my other co-hosts. Why don't you guys say something?
Introduce
that's your
us,
fucking
that's
cue.
Your slate.
Okay, Andrew.
D&D is a bad game.
Nice. And Connor.
Hi.
It's terrible. Okay, now since this is episode number one, and we're completely unknown people, we have no following or whatever, we're going to probably start out with a little bit, very, very small amount of all of our backgrounds on D&D, how long we've been playing, what we like about it, that kind of stuff. And I guess I'll just go first. My first experience with D&D was about 4 years ago, at my friend Ben's house. We played through the 4th edition starter set, and we had a combat that was supposed to take, I think, 10 minutes that took 2.5 hours of real time. Connor, you were there for that. It was more than 2.5,
wasn't it? It was
pretty bad. It was like
4. We were there, like, the entire evening.
Sounds like 4th ed.
And his Mormon brother, tried to seduce the dragon. it was 4th edition, so then we didn't play D&D for like 3 years.
And then 5th ed came out and fixed everything.
That's true. So I was like, hey, I will start up a D&D game, it'll be really fun. And I invited Ben, because he really wanted to play D&D, and I invited Connor. And this other guy, Ethan, who might be on the show eventually, and this other guy, Craig. You know, it was super cool, legit and awesome for 2 sessions, and then Ben quit and because he got angry at people for not knowing their skills or something, and also because they, like, threatened the tax collector in broad daylight with murder and got punished for it, which was, I think, kind of my fault, I don't know, as the DM. And then that fell apart completely, so I gave up on D&D forever until I went to college, and then it was like, hey, we should play some D&D to, like, do stuff together. So we all agreed before we left for college that we were going to do that. And then 6 months later, we actually rolled up characters and did all the stuff once again. And that had Connor in it, and then also Andrew, who's a very dear friend. And I've been running that game for like 1.5 years now. It's been pretty fun. And that's pretty much it, actually. In terms of experience, I really only got exposed to D&D like 5 years ago in any capacity. But I have been DMing fairly consistently, playing in college groups and that kind of stuff. So that's basically my story. Moving on to Connor.
Alright. As Anthony said, I have pretty much played the same amount of time he has. I played a little bit less because he's done some DMing for other campaigns. I don't do any DMing myself, I'm just a player. I go and ruin games, I don't run them. I have overall enjoyed myself. I like hearing what these guys come up with for their sessions. Try to get good feedback, and I'm guessing that's part of what this is all about.
Slightly, yeah. It's more about how everyone else can improve through our failures.
Exactly.
There's a long list.
Yeah. And last but not least, we have Andrew.
Alright, first things first. I don't know what you're talking about not being internet famous. I have like 1 million followers on all of them social medias.
I think you have like less than 50, don't you?
Anyway, so I knew D&D basically just through the public culture, pop culture consciousness there. I only really started to play it as kind of a... We had like an off period in high school around sophomore year, and me and a bunch of people played 4th ed. It was alright. My only try to get back into it again later was with a mutual friend of ours, Anthony, Vicky, and a friend of hers named Jen, who wanted to play GURPS. And that's not D&D, but that's just tabletop games. And that didn't really take off. We got, like, character creation. That didn't do much else. And then after that, I go to college. And I get a text from Anthony. And I'm like, what the fuck does he want? And he's like, you want to play D&D? And I said, well, of course I do. And then I ruined his game. And several months later, after another friend, mutual friend of all of ours, had another campaign, which I also did ruin, I would say so. I decided I...
I think I ruined that one. I think that was me and Connor that ruined that one, actually. You were a good player. You had a character with a cool backstory who wasn't a total asshole. All
right. And then, one amazing evening, in between the fits of depression of hating school, it came to me. I should DM my own campaign. And from that moment on, I was a changed man. And so, after many delays, we finally had session zero. And after many more delays, we finally had session one. And after a seemingly unending amount of delays, we had session two. And I think it's all up from here.
I sure hope so.
We'd have session three in a few months.
Yeah, in about three months. What? Next time, Hunter updates, we'll have a session. Should be like 3 years, bare minimum.
You see, this is part of the marketing for the podcast, is because Andrew knows about all the weeb shit, which neither me nor Connor know about. So, you know, he can do all that stuff and get that market. Connor can get the curmudgeon market, and I can impress people with how grossly incompetent I am at everything.
It's how I can make anime references and none of you can catch me. And I can get away with it.
I mean, that was a pretty blatant reference.
Yeah, that was a pretty blatant reference. The only thing I've referenced so far in my campaign is Hateful Eight, because the plot of the first session was just the Hateful Eight. I didn't know at the time of writing it, but that after I ran it, I'm like, oh, that was just the Hateful Eight. And then Big Boss from Metal Gear Solid. I needed a name for him, and why not?
He's a leader of a guild. So, our two campaigns started very differently. Namely, I kind of, like, threw you guys into, like, a weird dungeon altogether. You all fell down a hole, actually, which has plot significance that you'll see later. Whereas you went for a more traditional start in a bar, and then you get picked up by some kind of guild approach. And actually, we have a neutral party now, so we could ask him, what were your pros and cons of those two approaches, Connor? What did you think was better about each?
I mean, obviously Andrew's felt a lot more... I'm going to say a lot more. It's still obviously not, like, natural, but it felt more natural. The way that yours began, we just kind of fell into a hole, and... still not really sure how that was. It's kind of one of those things where the world is so magical that just walking down the street, you might get eaten by a manhole or something.
Which is also true in certain parts of Southeast Asia and Detroit.
Anyways, however, I do think that our characters in your campaign probably had a quicker bit of interaction that got each other acclimated to the party's skills, like what each person was capable of, whereas the first thing in your campaign, Andrew, was just kind of a bar fight. A bar fight that we all just kept missing attacks. So,
and then a lot of people got murdered.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of hard to judge at this point since they've been running for such different amounts of time. But I think, just what I've seen so far, it seems like our characters in Anthony's campaign, they got to know each other a lot quicker. Perhaps because of that, I don't really know.
Yeah, I would sort of agree, because I am a player. I play a Arakokra, I don't know how to pronounce it, bird-person cleric. Yeah, and Andrew's campaign, you know, and it's sort of like... Everyone had different... I don't want to, like, play at my own thing, because I actually think that Andrew's made more narrative sense, and it wasn't just like, oh yeah, this happened to you. But I do think that there is a certain extent of you want to start out a campaign in a way that your characters can all work together as a unit pretty quickly, And that did happen with yours, because eventually the cult starts attacking us, right?
Yeah.
But there was a lot of time before that where it was basically just me and Ethan's character doing something. Because what happened in the session was... So we're all just sitting at a bar or whatever. There's some guy who's freaked out, you know, seems a little nervous, who's also at the bar. I cast Detect Poison, or whatever it's called. The cleric spell, and then it's like, oh, there's poison behind the thing. And then it turns out that the tiefling bartender was very unusual because the proprietor of the bar was incredibly racist against tieflings. And the whole bar was really like a setup to kill the guy who was nervous. But for a good portion of that, it was literally just me and Ethan's character, who was a rogue. You know, I say there's poison, he's like, I'll go take it. You know, that seems dangerous. He grabs it, and then we got a little more interaction with, another Connor's character.
You know, like, half a dozen Connors?
Yeah, well, there's three that are all in the D&D things, and it's horribly confusing. But, you know, so his character kind of joins in, and then the third Connor's... character, like, joined in a little bit after that, but, like, it did feel like the level of interaction with each other was a little uneven. And honestly, like, looking to the future, if I had to do it all over again, I would just basically, like, request that people's backstories involve each other somehow. But that also kind of limits, like, choice. So, I don't know. What do you think?
I think what I came up with would have been perfect for a group of three people, not five. I think, like, as a entire setup, the whole walking into an assassination attempt at a bar, I just think for just the number of people, I think would have worked better with a smaller party, but that's just kind of a, you can't really figure it out until you try it.
And to a certain extent, it doesn't really matter as much. I think that there's a big, I don't know if you guys would agree with me on this, I think that there is a big push in the community. Push is not the right word. There's like a feeling in the community that you need to have a really good, like, cohesive narrative session one. And to some extent that is true, because you need to put your best foot forward. On the other hand, though, generally how characters meet is not necessarily as interesting as here's a cohesive team that work together. You know, like, the origin of the A-Team is something where it's just like, oh, they're wrongly accused of a crime or something, and now they're soldiers of fortune. Whatever. We don't need to see them get sentenced and go to prison, you know. That's not as cool as watching them, like, you know, pity the fool. I've never actually seen an episode of the A-Team, but I just assume that they have, like, kooky capers or whatever.
That show's amazing. Watch it.
It's from the 80s, so I think everyone listening probably thinks you guys are, like, 30 or 40 years old now.
I mean, no, but, like, nostalgia's kish. It's kish. And I just said kish. That it was in college, so... I don't know. What do you think, Connor? For Session 1s. You've been in more Session 1s as a player than any of the rest of us, actually. Except for Andrew.
I don't know. I think that I agree that having a fairly solid narrative Session 1 is definitely the best way to go. I think that, you know, obviously in every situation that I've been in, it's, you know, you're thrust into a situation that's very high energy, and, you know, it, a lot of the time it's just fight or die. And that somehow pushes you into the rest of the adventure. I think that's a good way to go. I think that, and this is probably a bit harder for DMs, and I obviously haven't really done it before, so I couldn't say, but I think that session ones, in my mind, should also have enough opportunity for the players to make choices, like individual characters, to demonstrate what their personality is like, what they would do given a certain situation, and not like to just demonstrate like, oh, this person's a rogue or this person's a wizard, but like, if you're, say, the cleric of the party, you'll get to see the guy who is playing your rogue. He'll, you know, make a certain decision morally or logically, maybe, that will demonstrate how he interacts with the world, and give you an idea of how you'll have to interact with him later on.
Yeah. I felt like Andrew's first session was actually quite good at that, in the sense of sort of... Well, the problem is it was really only kind of... We had incomplete information, because it's me and Ethan's character who know about there's poison, there's something weird going on. And then I guess we did get to see how the other characters, like, interacted or whatever to, you know... By interacted, I mean that the half-orc comes and grabs Ethan's character and is like, "You're stealing, stop!" You know, so, and he has kind of like an accent and sounds kind of like slow talking. So you're like, oh, okay, so this guy's like he's like a good old country boy, which I think is what he was going for to some extent.
Yeah, and party conflict, it's always a great way to make friends.
Yeah, it was great. You know, and that did lead to some of that, but I felt like it was sort of like Connor's 1 and 3. Their characters were a little left out of that exchange.
Admittedly, that was my fault.
Well, yeah, in your case, your character was passed out in the...
She suffers from an extreme case of narcolepsy.
I don't know. It went pretty well. I felt like Session 2 maybe went a little bit better. So Session 2, we got contact, so the guy who got murdered was in a guild. And so his friends are like, bruh, you should join our guild and we'll give you money. And I'm like, yeah, money's okay, I'm cool with money. And everyone else was like, whatever, sure. And we had the choice of 2 jobs, one of which was save orphans and one of which was go find a cool meteorite. I will say that's like... It's not bad that you did this, but it was kind of like you gotta go save the orphans, pretty much, because it's like their kids, or whatever.
No, you can finish the thought, but then I'll tell you what I was thinking when I did that.
No, I actually want to hear this,
okay.
Go ahead.
So, essentially I came up with the idea. Lizard folk cult worshipping the meteor, awesome. But that's one path, and I wanted to have, multiple paths, because railroading your...
Wait a minute, friend. Both paths for lizard folk?
Okay, let's circle back. I was going to originally have 3 paths, each of which would have been completely different. One was going to be the dungeon crawl with Lizardfolk, one was going to be another assassination plot, and one was going to be a mystery. And by the time I finished the dungeon crawl writing, I'm like, holy shit, I have to do this 2 more times. Fuck that. And so I concatenated it so that whichever one you picked, gameplay-wise, would have been the same. But now, spoiler alert, for the end of the session... Because one of them really wanted to do the meteor quest, they're going to next session, it's going to be different. It's not going to be I'm pretty sure it's not going to be a dungeon crawl. I'm going to, try something different, and something else will happen. I haven't written it yet, but gameplay-wise, like, I knew, like, okay, I want a travel encounter, which in the second session was when you guys got robbed, and that went pretty well. They died pretty quickly. I'm like, alright, I got you to use, like, a spell slot or 2, whatever. And then the second encounter, which triggered you find the kid and he points you to where the dungeon is, where all the other poor orphans are, you almost got TPK'd. You almost all died. And I was thinking to myself, oh crap, you almost got downed. Like, I was like, oh god, they have 2 more combats. Even more, just like that. They have 2 more combats just like that, even more if they trigger other combats. If, like, they trigger the optional ones.
And we'll get onto the optional combat a little later, because
that was
pretty special.
That was
I don't know. A lot of people get angry because they're like, there's no meaningful choice if both paths lead to the same thing. And for me, it's just like, you chose which one, but, like, mechanically it's the same. It doesn't really matter if it's different story-wise, is, like, my perspective. At the same time, in my campaign... I can't really ever remember doing, like, here's option A, B, C, but they're all real doors to the same thing. I don't think I've ever actually done that. But I think that's mostly because my DM style involves significantly less planning than yours seems to.
Yes, because I'm a perfectionist who cannot improv or shit. Absolutely. Even though the few things I improv last session went well, but yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, though. Like... You only know they would have been the same because I told you. You weren't...
I know.
It's going to be different. It's not going to be a dungeon crawl. It's just the level of planning...
I'm saying that from a... Like, because people do argue that that's a bad thing. I don't necessarily agree with that, right? I don't think that that's true.
Yeah, those people are called wrong.
But there is, like, I don't know. Connor, what do you think?
About what specifically?
Sorry. He was doing some stuff. I'm going to go back. Well, there are people who do say that it's like, it's bad to do that, to have two doors to the same thing and to have two dungeons, you know, choose dungeon A or dungeon B and they're both the exact same dungeon. In your case, I think that that was probably fine because it was a pretty weird binary choice anyway. But Connor, do you disagree with that at all? Or were you okay with the fact that if we had went for the meteorite, it would have been lizards guarding meteorite as opposed to lizards guarding some about to be sacrificed children?
I mean, I don't really mind. We were meant to deal with, you know, one of them, and the idea was that we weren't really meant to have enough time to do both, so if there's just time constraints on what you can come up with for a session, then, you know, it's hard to really be upset about that. I think that, obviously, I like having a pick from a lot of different content, but I mean, if it's something I don't really know, it doesn't hurt me that much.
Yeah, I essentially...
Which I would agree with.
I essentially pulled back the curtain now, but...
That's fine. Whatever. That's the point of the podcast. You can see what your DMs are doing. Spoiler, they're all lazy fucks.
Pretty much, but... No, this is... It was only really done that because I'm doing it with school right now, and... Who knows? Chances are I'm going to be a total fucking neat all summer, so... 10 different paths, each completely unique, totally fleshed out characters, paragraphs of in-game handouts. All the fucking shit. Yeah, sorry, go.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, for me, planning is mostly like, here's the characters in the scenario, and here's a couple maps. And that means that I can get through some planning very quick. But other things take me a little longer, because it takes me longer to come up with, like, what I think is a compelling situation, because I feel like it needs to be very compelling if I can improv through it. So, I tend to focus more towards that stuff. And every time I have tried to really, like, plan everything out, it's been kind of a disaster. So...
Wait, which ones did you completely plan out?
Well, earlier in my campaign, they visited a gnome town on a spiral... Okay, so my campaign is set in a very weird world that has fractals of land called tendrils going everywhere, right? And you can, like, walk along them or whatever, and you find some towns and stuff. Like, people are located along these land masses that just kind of float around the air and have their own gravity and their own light source and their own heat and completely break physics because LOL magic. And the problem with that session... was that it sucked. They go into this gnome town, and they're like, there's some kobolds. The party likes kobolds because they hung out with Colonel Mac for reasons.
We slept in his bar.
I promise.
We slept in his
bar.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
It makes sense.
In context.
Now we're fighting a holy war for him? Or a holy competition of one-upmanship. A holy dick-measuring contest.
It's complicated. The point is... they get to this town and they're like, there's some kobolds, kill them. And they're like, we don't want to kill kobolds. And they get there and there's a kobold guy with like an evil artifact and it's like turning him evil. And then it's like, it's going to turn them evil. And then they go into this like complex involved dungeon and every part of it's like way over planned and railroady and awful. And it hurts my brain to run. And the players are all like unenthused and they're like, meh. And while Andrew specifically did get a pretty badass sword and did get to punch
it's
a shark in the face.
I loved it. No, it was a crocodile.
Yes. It was still kind of like, this should have been more dynamic and more interesting, and I shouldn't have been like, oh crap, this is supposed to happen. Well, so you talk to some gnomes and they tell you that they're magicians and this artifact is going to turn you evil, Lamau. And I'm just sitting here, and I'm like, oh no, why'd I do that? So, you know, ever since then, actually, I've been trying to plan less and just been like, here's what my scenario is, here's what my characters are like, here's what the combat are. And not like, here's, you could solve it by doing A, B, C, or D as much.
Well, here's the thing about that, Anthony, is I don't think that was your worst session. I remember that session, I thought it was pretty okay. Not your best. Which will always be, for me anyway, a tie between the small-scale war, because it was just fucking insane.
And Lizard Man Vietnam.
Yes, it was absolutely crazy. And the shaving cream mystery, because it was just so absurd. But I think your worst session was one that we had recently, right before we went to the dragon, was that we just recently did, the sodium-spewing dragon. Was just kind of the super improv one. We bought stuff, and then we fought each other just to, like, spar. And then there was some minor plot development.
Yeah, okay, that was my worst.
Because I think you literally had nothing planned then.
Well, the reason why is because someone else was supposed to run a game that week and then told me literally, I think, 8 hours before the game started, hey, I can't do this. Can you come up with something? And like a moron, I said yes. And I just had nothing at all planned. I was planning on doing stuff, and then I went to one of my classes and realized that I had done a homework incorrectly, and I had to like go back and redo it really quick because it was like due that night. So I spent all my time doing that. I had literally nothing done, and I'm like, whatever, they'll just shop and then they'll go someplace. And sessions like that can actually really hurt your story, right? Because, you know, they can just completely interrupt the flow of everything and screw up the tone really bad. And I would agree that there is a sweet spot to planning.
Yes. And
that was my worst by far. Yes. That is true. I actually forgot that happened. I blocked it from my memory.
And so now you have a rock bottom. And so it's only up from there.
Speaking of which, Connor, would you agree that I guess you could, like, spar each other. Oh, you go back to this area and some people exposit at you for, like, 5 minutes. Clumsily. Would you agree that that's the worst?
I hated that session with a passion. and, like, the worst part about it is that it was, like, the only session we had of your campaign in, like, a month's time, so by the time we actually played another session, I just had no idea what was happening at that point. Like, it had been so long, nobody knew what was happening. We're just like, well, I guess we should go kill something.
Yeah.
It's...
And that is, I think, actually the one thing that sucks the most about DMing. We're gonna move on to this topic. Consistent.
I have a little set before you switch it. Just write down what you're gonna change it to, but the thing with planning, and on that, is I like to plan, because whenever I improv stuff, I'm like, oh, I need to make sure I get everything said, because as of right now, and I'm going to be very vague about this, because, you know, plot's still happening, I have told you stuff, some minor details about the overarching plot, of, like, a larger plot going on, and I wanted to make sure that I said those things. And so I had to, you know, like, in my improv, like, the little thing, I'm like, did I say everything I need to say to you? Like, I think I even said to you, I'm like, does he say anything else? No, he doesn't. He's finished his talking there. Versus if I had written out a complete monologue, like, I remember one of the details, it was just him talking for, like about, you know, like, 30 seconds at you guys. If I had just written it out, I could have made sure that all of this information is there, and thus I wouldn't have given, you know, kind of a tell of, oh, you're trying to make sure he said everything to us. He must be saying something important for later, which in a way kind of, not spoils it, but kind of tips you off to certain things. And so that's why I plan, like you write out monologues. That's why I plan, like I have a list, even like when I'm not like writing out the full like dialogue of it, I have a list of, here is what this character says to him. Like the big boss thing when at the beginning of the second session, everything that he was going to say to you was already bullet pointed out. Like he says, "Hey, good job. So have a good night's rest. Which job you want?"
Yeah. Okay. I think the only time I've ever actually done a written out monologue was there's a major twist in the campaign at one point where like the one of the main conflicts was fully revealed. After a very old divine being came back and was like, you all suck, we're gonna clean house and make gods great again. And that's, I think, the only time I've ever actually written out dialogue ahead of time. Except for in that water temple, I had some garbage, like, poems and shit on the wall that was awful. And I don't know, it's not necessarily, like... I'm just assuming that, like, NPC dialogue is, like, always gonna be somewhat important. So that didn't really tip me off as much. But your style of planning is a little different because, like, I know certain things and we all know certain things about, like, here's the campaign is going to be about this thematically. It's going to eventually go here.
Okay. So, for the record, you know one detail that's reasonably plot important.
That's especially yeah, no. For, but I mean, like the overarching thing you told everybody.
The overarching thing. No, I don't believe you'd know. And then there's another.
Well, you mentioned to the entire party at the start of your campaign that some guy was gonna do something. You know, he's gonna invent these things. And
oh yes, yes,
be
yes.
About...
Like I sold them on the idea that part of this campaign, which has become essentially the second half of it, is going to be Shadow of the Colossus meets the Wild West. And so there will, and guns aren't there right now. How will they get there? Who knows? They'll be there eventually. Someday.
Sorry, that's very different in style from kind of what I did, where I didn't actually say, here's what's going to eventually happen, here's what the game's going to be like later, and it's going to be X meets X, or the second half is going to involve you doing this. I really, actually, my initial pitch to you was, like, I have this kind of neat world and a cool story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like those are two... There's upsides and downsides to both. I kind of like yours a little better, honestly, because it's like, here's where we're going. But at the same time, it is also kind of like, okay, I have this character, and at some point she's going to have to deal with this, as opposed to, for her, like, guns being invented or whatever. That's going to be pretty crazy, right? If you're, like, a medieval peasant, and all of a sudden you have, like, a flintlock, or, like, something that's more accurate than that, like an actual rifle, you know, that, like, suddenly changes your whole world. And it's going to be maybe a little harder to play that. At the same time, though, I could make a character who would be able to handle that. I specifically created Mierit, the name of my character, in such a way where it's, like, she can still be effective under those parameters,
yeah.
Which would have been very hard to do otherwise. So, in a sense of long-term planning and telling your players about it, I think that that's a big upside. But it does, I think, have a slight downside in that it is removing some degree of tension because we know it's going to go here eventually. We might not necessarily... Yeah. But since we don't know how it's going to get there or what we're really going to be doing besides presumably fighting giant monsters with guns, it's kind of like... Well, you know, there's still a fair amount of tension in it. It's not completely spoiled. It's not like you told us, and the final fight is going to be this, and you have to hit the glowing, you know, flip it over and hit its weak point for massive damage.
So there's this one boss in Dark Souls called the Witch Izalith, and it's literally, the final boss is just going to be a one-to-one of that. It's not actually a boss, it's a puzzle, and once you solve the puzzle, the boss is actually a bug that dies in one hit. That was a joke.
I like it.
Yeah, the Witch Eyes.
Connor!
Sorry. Oh, go.
I don't know. That stuff is hard to find a good balance with, because, I mean, with that particular scenario, with the way that you described your campaign the first time, Andrew, like, with our group, it's a bit easier because, I mean, we have nothing better to do, but with other groups... It's probably important to get across that that's some of the stuff you're planning on doing with the campaign, because certain players wouldn't necessarily like that sort of, that style of campaign as well. So, I can see where it would be hard to find a good balance between saying what is going to be happening with the campaign without telling too much. Because, you know, there are people that would obviously prefer more of a just traditional fantasy setting, and I don't, as I said before, I don't think anybody in our particular group cares one way or the other, but I can see that as being a bigger problem for some DMs.
Especially if you're DMing for random people. That is so much harder than DMing for friends.
And
just
talking as a player, I definitely do prefer to know at least on a basic level what sort of campaign I'm getting into before I go into it.
Yeah.
Like, if there was one thing that I would have liked with one of the other Connor's campaigns. Connor 2. I would have liked to know a bit more about kind of what style of campaign it was going to be before going in, because with my character, I didn't feel like it was necessarily a good fit for the setting.
Yeah, same here.
So, I mean, there's There's definitely pros and cons to that stuff. I think overall, it's one of those things where you have to pick your words very carefully so that, I mean, also from a player perspective, you don't want to know too much because at a certain point you're like, well, that's kind of a giveaway now. I'm going to be waiting for it the entire time. So.
And like,
But it also creates some sense of anticipation. Because, like, now I'm like, I want to get my hands on a fucking rifle, right? Like, that's going to be super legit. You know, I can't wait.
and for that's coming later. Like the first, you're already at level 3 and you've only had 2 sessions, and I wanted at least the first 3 levels to go very, very quickly, because honestly, we've all played them through. They're fucking boring. Their swingy is all shit and hard to make for. So it's going to slow down now, level-wise. Because, like, I even said, like, first few level, like, we had a session 0 of just how do I run a fucking combat in Roll 20, which is still fucking abysmal. But after that, I pretty much decided myself, yeah, after the first encounter, you're going up to 2, definitely. But, and on the whole, like, sales pitch I had, the Shadow of the Colossus meets Wild West, my worry with that is it's not that right now. And I'm like, oh, here's my sales pitch. And people are like, okay, I'll build a character for that. And I'm like, okay, so now you're in this. Still pretty medieval. Like, I originally sold it as mid fantasy, but honestly, it's high. I think it is high fantasy. It's just the other campaigns we've been in have just been so out there. Like, one of them was like absurdist and very comedic and very like tonally different.
And in my campaign, you can ride your flying motorcycle and request an audience with a god directly
Yeah, and yours
before,
is like.
you know, leaving to go and gamble with the mafia. So.
It's just so high, it's just off the fucking chart. So when it's bringing down to like, yeah, this is just reasonable high fantasy, it feels like it's something really fucking lower. But, and so when I did that, and when I came with the idea of that, I'm like, oh, that's a pretty cool idea. How did it get there? And then when I started coming up with like character arcs for NPCs, because I wanted it to have, you know, some level of story to it, I'm like, oh, I can make a compelling story about how this world came to be and then where it's going. And what's happening, and the important people in this world. And so that's more or less where you are now, is the foundations of that setting are being, you know, set. It's the seeds are being sown, and they sh and it'll come to be reaped later in time.
You know what's interesting? I don't think I actually planned any major character arcs for NPCs ahead of time because it's kind of like entirely dependent on what you guys do in my campaign, right?
Well, yeah.
You know, like a really good example. I was actually completely expecting you to just okay. I need to scroll back a little and give some more context. This will get less bad as the podcast goes on, and hopefully, whoever's listening to this sort of understands what our games are like. At a certain point, they found out that a seemingly useless magical artifact they had was actually specifically designed to cull the herd in the sense of kill like one or more gods or something, and that this is very some very rare event happens like once every 100,000 years, whatever. And they got to choose who. And I thought for sure they were going to use it on Colonel Mac. I thought 100% they're going to just euthanize the poor guy, you know? Because it's like, who else do we use it on? It's so difficult. And they wound up not choosing him at all. Everyone was like, nah, I believe that this guy can be better at his job, you know? So his arc, as opposed to, I wanted to be like super depressing to like foreshadow something later on. But instead, it was like, we're going to help you become the best god you can be, and it's going to be, you know, happy and fun. So I feel like I don't know. It would be very interesting for me to like try to plan some characters ahead of time, just because I've never done it for a D&D campaign. And it sounds like you spend a lot of time on it, right?
Yes, I have most of the different in my head so far of the NPCs, most of them, yeah, I've planned ahead. On the note of the one, and what's kind of changed is about Big Boss, the guy who basically runs the guild you all joined in mine, who basically gives you missions and shit in a very video game style. But I do that in other campaigns anyway. I always write up an itinerary, so I'm like, I'll fucking do this for you so that you never forget, oh, what are we doing next? It's kind of. And how at the end of the last session, you all talked about what you thought of, you know, Big Boss, and like, you're like, yeah, he's kind of a shady dude, and you feel like, oh, he has some sort of ulterior motive. He's hiding something. And you ask me, like, oh, what does his office look like? What does he look like? And all that. And that hasn't really changed what I want Big Boss's arc to be, but it solidified a few things about him that I wanted to do. In that, if that makes sense. Like, and so there's other characters you will run into eventually. Like, my general rule of thumb is, if I bother to give this character a name that I didn't come up with on the spot, if I bother to give this character a unique voice, if it's still early in the session and I'm, you know, still doing voices before my throat is shot to shit, because that happens, like, really fucking fast. And if I tell you some level of different detail with this character, like, if you learn something else about this character outside of, you know, their usual, oh, they run the store.
Or they whatever, do X, they do Y.
There's something, you know, there's a hook there. Let's just put it like that. There's a fucking hook there, because even if you decide, oh, that's a pretty obvious plot hook, fuck that, you know, it's not completely dependent. Like, well, my story isn't shot to shit. There's other ways to go about it.
Hmm.
Unless you go on a murdering spree, in which case, yeah, the story's shot to shit.
Just go full... Well, there's not many campaigns that can react well to the players just deciding to pull a Columbine. But, like, I feel like the one issue I would see for that in the future is, and like, you guys have occasionally looked at characters who were just supposed to be background characters, and they developed really quickly into, like, people who you cared about, and all of a sudden it's, like, they're a named NPC that has their own unique voice. Like, they have all that stuff, and I didn't plan for that at all. Like, the barkeep Stella, who's this person who was literally just supposed to be at a bar that you guys went to at a certain point, and then all of a sudden, not only does that bar become kind of like a base of operations or whatever, but you know, wind up caring for that character and trying to help her out as time goes on. What do you think, Connor?
I mean, I think that quality of your sessions is definitely the better once you started doing more with just improving in reaction to what we do. I think that there is a certain degree that the DM needs to kind of keep things on track, but, you know, giving player freedom is obviously one of the biggest things about D&D. You know, you want them to have options. And, I mean, there's kind of a spectrum with that as well. Like, with your campaign, I'd say we are definitely directed in certain places, towards certain places a lot more. More so than in some of the other campaigns that we've played in. But I feel like that isn't a problem. It's just a different way of doing things. We still have choices and we can come up with our own ways of going about handling situations. And I think that as a DM, you've gotten much better with dealing with that.
Yeah, unfortunately, when it comes to, like, Andrew's thing, I don't think we have enough sample data to really talk about it as much. It was cool that we got assaulted by highwaymen, and you kind of let us, like, they were like, oh, just pay the toll, like, we'll be fine. Yeah. And then we were like, nah.
Yeah, that was mostly
we
just
killed, like, half a dozen people.
That was,
over half a dozen.
That was mostly just, the highwayman encounter was mostly just a, I want to get him to use, like, a spell slot or two, I want to have more than one combat, and I want the session to last longer than, like, an hour and a half. Because session zero, obviously, was short. Session one was, like, 2 hours, compared to the usual 4 hour plus of other people's campaign. So I'm like, yeah, want a bit more of a time sink in. And then one of them rolled very well on a persuasion check of, hey, because he was also a rogue who's meant to be, like, this kind of, like, roguish, kind of, like, just smooth criminal type. And so he's like, hey, honor amongst thieves, right? And so the guy's like, rolled very well, like, over, like, a 23 or something. And so I'm like, okay, you swayed this guy. He's like, all right, we won't kill you. Just pay us money and we'll leave you alone. And he didn't have the money. And if he rolled really well again, then the guy would have stood down. I would have improv'd that he would have told them to stand down. Or if he hadn't rolled a good intimidation, they would have just fucked off. But nope. And now you killed, like, half a dozen, like, people. What the fuck is wrong with
you? It was self-defense. Self-defense.
No, those were actual toll workers. It was a Halloween party. They all dressed up like bandits as a joke.
Oh, well, I guess that we're murderers, then.
Can I make a quick note about your campaign, Andrew?
Go for it.
So at the very end of your session, you specifically asked, like, do any of you want to ask questions about each other? You know, just get to know your co-workers that you just helped murder, like, 30 people with. And though that was, like, super forced, I think it's almost a good idea to do in one of the first couple of sessions, because I think, as far as character interaction goes, just getting the ball rolling is maybe the hardest part, because you end up with these situations, like, I kind of feel like we're this way in Anthony's, where we don't know a ton about each other, because from the very beginning of the campaign, we've just been bopping around dealing with stuff in rapid succession. To the point that I feel like I don't know a ton about the people I'm working with, but with yours, now that I've at least been in a conversation with the other people in the party, and have an idea of at least what their goals are, it's a good thing to do early, because now that'll lead to, okay, well, what steps are you trying to take right now to dealing with that problem? Or, you know, is there any way that we can help, or is there any particular town that we need to go to that could potentially help you deal with this? And I think getting that off our chests early is definitely a good thing. And despite the fact that it was, as I said before, a bit forced, it hopefully will lead to more natural progression of that stuff later.
Alright, yeah. It's... Yeah, that was kind of a super forced thing. There was also the like, time before...
I feel like it's fine to force character interaction like that. Oh, well, I wish I had done that more.
I think you did once, while we were on a bus.
Yep.
Or the equivalent of a bus. But early on, whilst you were walking, before you all almost got robbed, you were talking with each other a lot, and I'm like, oh, sweet, this is kind of what I wanted it. Like, you just walk while on your way, talk on your way there, and then once the conversation kind of died down, then the merry band of thieves decides to fucking try and take your shit. But it was forced, but I'm glad it kind of comes out so that you yourselves could figure out your character and that I could figure out what you specifically are going for, because, like, at the end of both sessions, I've basically written down, like, at the end of the session, what did they want? Like, at the end of the first one, I wrote down, you know, Mierch wants to go to, like, the Arcane College to find this powerful wizard, because she's looking for a powerful wizard of a certain esoteric magic. I won't spoil it, because I think you're also hiding that from the other players. Yep. And then, from yours, Stouter, that you're just trying to find a certain somebody.
Yes,
and to murder him.
Yeah, to fucking murder him. Or just have a very strongly worded conversation. Whichever works. But... And I'm like, okay, now they know what their character's goals are as what they're attempting. And it reinforces it for me. Because it just keeps it in notes and, like, what to keep in mind as I write more. So, yeah, it was railroady. As a general, I have a very weird, like, philosophy with railroady in that I think the greatest thing with player choice, like, I think the pinnacle of it is... I mean, it's not necessarily pinnacle, not necessarily this is the way it has to be done, but I think the best way to deliver a good story is Telltale, what they did with, you know, Telltale's Walking Dead, where you think you have a choice. You didn't, but you thought you did. And you only know because you looked it up afterwards. Or you played it again.
But to a certain extent, that's kind of less... That's very hard to do correctly because, like... It can become incredibly transparent.
Yeah, you have to
especially
hide it.
Especially because in D&D, you don't get a choice between A, B, and C, right? You get to do whatever. So if you're just like, well, you know, you run into a situation... actually, I'll give you an example from my college campaign. They were in a really scary, spooky-ass dungeon, and there was a red dragon that was, like, cursed to be there. And it's like, you have to take one of these three trials, and one of them's the red dragon. And they just removed cursed him. And all of a sudden, my crazy puzzle on how to kill him without getting killed is just completely gone, because we have a paladin that knows remove curse. And I was just like, well, It works. And I feel like if you want it to be, like, if that was a big important story moment, which it wasn't really, but if it's like, oh, well, there's three ways to get past the dragon, you know, and if you don't account for that, and you want to do the Walking Dead thing, you're suddenly in, like, a huge hole. Like, you're like...
No. Yeah,
you're screwed, pretty much.
Essentially, and I obviously, like I said, that isn't the only way, and I'm obviously not going to do that with everything. It's like, but I think, as a tool, it's kind of a whole, for lack of a better word, kind of manipulating your players into thinking, oh, we should do this. Not like because you forced them into it, because they thought logically about what they and their characters would do, and this requires you to know their characters really well, but like, what they, their characters would do. Accounting for that, it's like, yeah, this is going to happen, they're going to do this. But I myself, in writing this campaign, have come into problems with that. Like, first campaign, I almost definitely thought the person who would discover the poison and the no tieflings, no dog sign would be you, Super. Because my experience with you as a player has been with you as your character Azir in Connor 2's campaign, who is very...
Please don't mention him.
Very standoffish and very... boisterous, let's say. So, as soon as he sends out there's poison, and he looks under, and he kind of, like, stubs his toe and finds a sign underneath the, desk that reads no dogs and tieflings in a bar that's being served that a tiefling is, you know, tending, he's going to call shit out rather than hold up a pretense. Or... So... And, like, I kind of bet, like, at first... You weren't... I mean, I think it was you and Ethan were both very inquisitive, but at first you weren't. Although I think you were the first one to do it. I thought you would have naturally been very inquisitive, like, from the get-go. Because, again, that was my experience with you. So I think, especially writing something like this, and again, it's not the end-all be-all. I am going to give you legitimate choice that actually matters, that actually differs, that doesn't just lead to the same mechanical encounter. But I think using this whole... I guess, for lack of a better term, false choice, even though I think that's a bit of a strong term for it, can be useful if you know who you were playing with, which I like to think I kind of do, because we've played through, like, three campaigns together, because we are all in the same group, so we play frequently, and just learning their characters, which you kind of figure out over time.
Well, the problem is, like, Mirit's personality, right, is very different from Azir's. You can still extrapolate data because you know me as a person, because we've known each other since, like, 7th grade,
yes.
You know, like, almost a decade now. But it's kind of like, I think it's slightly dangerous to assume that you're going to continue to be able to make accurate predictions and do the false choice thing, because people will surprise you, because it's just the fact that you have five people thinking about a situation, right? They're gonna come up with stuff that you can't come up with as, like, one person.
Oh, no, definitely. It's... I think I'm describing it very poorly, but... It's... And it's all... And like I said, this isn't the end-all be-all, and I don't think I'm going to use this, like, for everything, but I think it's kind of just, like, as a game design tool, the illusion of choice is sometimes more valuable than the choice itself. And I think... And this isn't my whole thing, and this isn't my whole, linear gameplay is the best thing ever. You either railroad your campaign, or your campaign fucking sucks. It's the whole, you can use it if you know how to use it properly. Unpopular opinion. Fight me on Twitter.
In my opinion, I don't like the... When I... want players to go somewhere, I typically set it up so that it's like they have no logical reason to go anywhere else, which to some extent is like the false choice thing, but when it comes down to like granular story decisions, or like how do you handle, like we had a mystery session at one point, right? And the mystery session was, there was a guy who was framed for murder. It turned out later that he wasn't even framed, it was just a freak accident. And the person who got murdered had accidentally killed himself, and the other guy just happened to be robbing his house at the time, so they just assumed he killed him. And, you know, it was an accident or whatever. And he's in prison, and he's gonna get executed, and it's like, this is really bad, and we have to, fix it. And in that case, I, like, as a GM, the narrative I want is you guys figure out, here's what happened. And I gave you little nudges there. But there was always option two, which was you guys were way more powerful than the town guards, and you could have just freed the guy by force. Or, you know, you could have done other similar things that were, like, way outside of that. And yes, you guys have surprised me in some cases. I, for example, the Lizard Folk War that you guys talked about, in my head, the scenario there is there's an army of lizard men that are going through, where they're going to sacrifice a bunch of people to get more power, and then they're going to go and take on another major city, and they kind of do a General Custer's Last Stand thing, where they just booby-trap the shit out of everything and put, like, mines in the ground and all sorts of other stuff like that. And, wind up sustaining ridiculous casualties in the town, but they fight off the lizard men. In that, story-wise, when I was planning it out, I actually thought that you guys were probably just gonna, like, evac the city. Like, that was a complete option, try to evac, and then you have to, like, make decisions about who to save, and you can maybe go back and do some covert stuff to slow the lizard men down to save more people, and you guys went in, like, a different direction. And I feel like if you are intending to do the Telltale thing, where it is, you can choose option A, B, or C, but behind all the doors is the same plot line, which obviously you said you're not going to do entirely.
Yeah.
I would caution against that, especially for huge story decisions. Because those can be a little, like, eh. It could feel, as a player, I've played in campaigns that have been like that, and it's never really been subtle. I don't really know. I'm not trying to call you out on this, no, for the record. I'm just because there's a lot of people who turned off the podcast because that's, I don't know, that's a very controversial thing, this discussion. There's people who are now picking sides. There are now people who are like, I'm an Andrew fan and I'm an Anthony fan. And then there's most people who are like, I'm deleting this podcast from my iPhone. But, you know, there's people who are taking sides in this.
It's not the end-all be-all linear gameplay. To tell a good story, you have to railroad them. I don't think that at all. And obviously for huge major plot points, it's about agency. So obviously for huge major plot points, it's going to be the choice and the reaction to that. Sorry, my computer, like, froze for a second, so I thought, like, oh fuck, it's all gone. But, it's a tool that can be used. Use it wisely.
And I would agree. I just tend to use it
a lot
less
of
and
knowledge
less as time goes on.
About the people, which I can use because I've known you all for several years. You especially, Super.
Yep.
And it requires knowledge of their characters. Like, say, like the whole evac thing, you can guess a few things based on the characters that, say, I play. You know I always play people who tend to be good. Which I was going to subvert, like, if my character in Connor 2's campaign died, because he's a bard, and bards have the awful habit of doing that, I was going to play a lawful evil character. In that he wouldn't go out of his way to, you know, be an asshole and just murder people, but he was going to be selfish. He was going to be someone who's like, should we save these innocent people? He's like, is there benefit to me? No? Then I don't care. And because I wanted to spice it up, but I always go out of my way to play people who tend to be good, and especially in the character in Connor 2's campaign, the bard, he was good to a fault in that he would get himself and the party into needless danger to save someone innocent. Like, there was a kobold named Mort who was about to be murdered for incompetence or letting us get infiltrate their base. And I'm like, this guy's just the janitor. He doesn't know what the fuck's going on. He doesn't deserve to be murdered. And then I just used Shatter, and thus combat started, and we all almost died. But we didn't, and that's what mattered. And it kind of gets into that, and that was, story-wise, was mirrored again in, like, the, kind of epilogue session me and Connor number 3 did in this campaign where we were in hell. And the whole shtick was we were saving Ethan's character, like, saying, hey, he should be able to ascend to heaven, save his soul and that. And so we were doing, like, this whole different, puzzles and encounters based on the 7 deadly sins. And the whole theme was that it was actually a fair in hell, because, like a circus and fair, because actual Christian hell would just be too depressing. And the whole shtick was, oh, if you eat food in hell, like the whole Persephone myth, you get stuck there. And so we had eaten that because, oh, it heals points and also a bunch of other things that had happened, a bunch of other contexts. And so now it's like, oh shit, we've almost damned ourselves here. And the character, you know, the bard just kept going like, oh, there's all these other people that the party screwed over throughout the campaign who died, you know, unnecessarily. I can save them too. Where it was pretty close to, no, you and Connor 3's character are now damned there too because you fucked up. I think even in the recording that we made of it, Connor 3 even said, if you made us, I'm not going to explain the whole mechanic, if you made us save one last time, we would be stuck here. And we eventually had to, like, have gold on us to get out, and we left with one piece left, and saving, like, cost money. And so it said, if I had listened to you, Andrew, and if we had saved one more time, we would have lost. And instead, we got, like, the best possible ending we could have. And so I think, like, and I got on this really long tangent and slash anecdote, but it's like, if you know the character and what they do, you can predict them slightly, but take it with a grain of salt.
Fair enough. Connor, what's your opinion?
D&D is a fun game.
No, it's not. It's fucking dog shit.
And speaking of dog shit, there's a new Unearthed Arcana. It's not necessarily that bad. However, I did some statistical analysis on certain parts of it, and I'm gonna say that there's something funny going on. We'll get into that later. But let's
like,
I think that this podcast is probably gonna run every 2 weeks, so we're gonna have a new UA every single time, and we're gonna go over it and review it and talk about all the cool things or bad things inside. This particular week's, in case for some reason you didn't know, is about downtime. It's about stuff that your players do to fill large gaps of time between adventures, so you can have... Well, yeah, and so you can have, like, a sense of time, so it's not just, like, Bob the Fighter saves the world literally every fucking day, right? He has some times where he just kind of does normal-ass human stuff when he's not out adventuring. Me, personally, I've never really saw as much appeal in... I have a character that has large amounts of downtime and goes carousing or whatever. Because I typically want to play my character, and I don't necessarily want to say... like, for me, it's less interesting to say, and then my character did this, if I don't get to play out them doing that. But I understand why people like it. And so, you know, I think that this is interesting, and it could definitely maybe be used for certain types of campaigns, and certain flavors of D&D, that I would like to try out. Because... You know, I don't think I'd like carousing that much, but I really haven't gotten the chance to do it, so maybe I think it'd be kind of fun to roll on tables and, you know, see what I've been up to, and kind of have let the character have a little bit of a life of their own.
Yeah.
So we'll start out with, basically, the first thing it does is it gives a whole list. So it says, like, here's some activities, and here's how this book's going to work, and it's going to have activities and complications and stuff. But the first major section is actually on foils. And these are supposed to be NPCs that aren't, like, trying to actively kill the players, necessarily, but that are working against the player's goals and are in some way an obstacle. I thought that this section was pretty good. Would you guys agree?
It's kind of the whole, like, thing with, like, oh, how to come up with, like, a writing thing. Like, it helps you with, like, oh, I should really include more, like, character foils. It gives you a good idea to start. If you don't have, like, an idea, like, you think, oh, I should include someone who's antagonistic but not, like, a big bad... is not just dungeon fodder, is not just, yeah, kill the character, or I'm trying to kill the party, mwahahaha. You just want someone who's working through using some resource against the party's wishes, or, like, against the party's goals. It's good, and it gives you some good ideas to, like, bounce off, and, like, oh, hey, that, you know, like, just reading the table. Rival adventuring party. Oh, I can do something with that. Or corrupt official paranoid that crimes will be revealed. Then you can just use that as, like, a jump-off point of, well, why is there a rivaling adventure party? What were their crimes? Why are they paranoid about them? What's their relationship to the party? It's a good jump-off point for a what is a very good character, like, not archetype, but, like, a good character, like, relationship to a party or to a player character. You know, foils and characters who are foils of others creates a very good dynamic in a narrative, if you're going for a more narrative something. Even if you're not going for a more narrative-based game, it can still work and be interesting.
Cool. Connor, what did you think?
I mean, I like the idea of foils. I think that it's something that, you know, DMs should try to include. Have kind of more minor villains, or, you know, it even described in here that they don't all have to be necessarily, like, villains, but just kind of antagonists that... your characters won't necessarily fight with, just have conflict with. It's good just for, it helps make certain characters, I want to say helps make them more interesting, but it kind of is like that. You know, You can do a lot towards making a character interesting just from character creation, but once the DM starts interacting with the character, it can go a lot further, because the player obviously isn't going to know the world nearly as well as the DM is. And the DM is educated enough on the setting to come up with a good...
Hopefully.
To come up with, like, a good minor character that might have, like, a bit of banter with the characters, or, you know, all out fight them sometimes. I think it was kind of funny how it described it in this, though. Like, there were some things that it was suggesting for the foils, like, oh, they send an assassin after you. But then there's others where it's like, he makes up a rumor about you, so you look like an idiot. Ah. It's just like, I just love this disparity between, you know, some big shady guy who wants you dead and, like, Snidely Whiplash.
it runs the spectrum from just a dick to someone actively trying to get killed.
I think it's good inspirational reading, though, overall. I think that it probably would make for interesting conflicts within a campaign outside of the main story.
Yeah. Okay, and then we get into the sample downtime activities, and here's where Anthony starts getting angry.
And it's
I hope, because every podcast needs to have characters, right? And that's why people join in. My hope is that Andrew's the reasonable one.
No, I'm not. I'm the iconoclast. I already said my bullshit opinions that are actually objectively correct, but nobody's going to agree with.
We can't have two people be, like, divisive and
players,
angry, though.
Players don't want choice. They want the illusion of choice.
Fine, I'll be the asshole that is always right but is still an asshole, and then Connor can be the voice of reason, even though Connor's natural personality is probably closer to asshole who's always right.
Listen, okay, before you get angry at it, here is my problem with downtime. And as I know, because I just want to get this said before you go into the actual, like, math and statistics that you ran on this, which proved why this is playtest material, not part of an official book yet, because the stats are off. But spoiler, but the thing with downtime is, before I started my campaign, I asked every single, like, I had this, like, game, sort of, like, quiz, like, what you like in a game, that I didn't make, that I found online. It's like, what do you like in a game? Do you like competition? Do you like excitement? Do you like social game? Do you like, oh, hey, that was a really cool design? Do you like narrative? Whatever. And I basically figured out that most of you guys went into two camps. Half of you are really into it just for the design and the experience of it, while the other half do appreciate a good story. Like, you all kind of appreciate a good story. You all generally, you can appreciate whatever, but you have your own preferences. And the thing that I've noticed, and I asked more questions about, oh, what were your favorite sessions in each of the campaigns you've been in with all of us? And what did you like about them? What were the parts that you didn't like? Because I wanted to build something good that you all enjoy. And what I have found is that when it comes to things like downtime, like, oh, you go shopping, that should be the shortest possible part of any session. Like, you shopping should take 20 minutes max of, like, say, a 4-hour session. It should not be that long. And so something like this, where it's much more involved, you know, like with downtime, like, oh, I spend it training. You know, that for that person that's interested, they're engaged. You know, they're rolling and trying to figure out what their character did. Everyone else doesn't give a shit. Everyone else is on their phone. And that's, you know, that just happens. That's just what people do. You know, it's not any slight to the DM, it's not any slight to the player. It's just, it doesn't affect them. Unless they're all working together. And it's like, and like I saw this recently with a recent session with yours, is like, we basically ended up in the Las Vegas equivalent. And so my character, who's absolutely loaded because he's bought like two things since the start of the entire campaign, because he's a fighter and he honestly just needs a weapon and armor. Like, why do you need anything else, honestly? Everyone's like, myself and my character both thought, oh, we're staying in a hotel tonight, might as well live it in style, just threw a bag of gold at the poor clerk lady, who's like, oh, okay, you sure you just didn't want to buy the whole building? And so I'm just like, oh, fuck it, I'll just throw the money away, just give me chips, and then they open this whole gambling minigame. Well, the gambling minigame, I'm just like, oh, like, I could tell people were fucking bored, they just wanted it to end and shit. I'm like, okay, bet it all on a roulette wheel, you randomly generated a number, he lost, gambling's over. And then Connor had his own side quest where he almost got murdered in a Motel 6. or something like that. And then became the hero of the village. But it's like, it's this very minor thing. It's like, people want, especially at least in our group, they want combat. They want very obvious story development. Like, they want a big reveal. They want a, oh, this is going back to the overarching narrative of everything. This is a huge development for this person's character. They want that. They don't want downtime. They don't, like, shopping is just so that they can do the other things, so that they have supplies to do other things.
Well,
so
this isn't all about shopping.
Yeah, I know, but it's like an example. Like, shopping, training, research,
yeah,
business, cruising, whatever. Yeah, they do. It's just the reason why I have this interest in it. Not like this interest. Like, I think, like, oh, it's pretty interesting. The reason I don't find this useful to me is because the group I play with isn't about, like, if I included stuff like this, you either, all of you guys wouldn't take it, or you would be bored by it. And I found that all of you people, yeah, you people, wouldn't be interested in it. You wouldn't, it just doesn't speak to you and what you want to do in a session. And that's just my thoughts. Okay. I just wanted it out. It's an interesting thing. If you like downtime, good for you. And I like, you can include it. You obviously can include it and just like, yeah, it's been, after say like a major arc ended, you'd be like, okay, what have you guys, here's, we'll find out what you guys have been up to, just kind of doing your thing. But it's spice, it's not the meal. That's your analogy.
But, okay. Let's break this shit down though. Regardless of whether or not downtime sucks, right? Downtime should be fun. And downtime yes. should be rewarding, and it should be a part of the game that players relatively enjoy. Especially because, according to this, downtime is almost entirely random. So the randomness should be balanced in such a way that it makes narrative sense. I am very into that. That's why I kind of like 5th edition in some ways, because it's like, you're a super strong, really powerful warrior or whatever, but you're still fucking around with deadly things, and you can still get killed by, like, you know, a group of orcs if you're just incredibly unlucky. As opposed to stuff like 3rd edition, where after, like, level 10, you're just a god and orcs can never touch you, right? Okay. So, buying a magic item is the first thing. Buying a magic item requires a charisma persuasion check to determine the quality of the cell you find, and you get a +1 bonus for every week beyond the first you spent trying to find a seller, and a +1 bonus for every 100 gold points spent on the search. This means that to get a high-level magic item, you either need to spend a shitload of money, or you need to take a shitload of time. I'm okay with that. Are you guys okay with that?
Yeah, the sunk cost makes sense so far.
Okay. My problem is the complications table. I would be really pissed off if any of these happened and it was just like a, oh, I rolled on this table. The item is cursed by a god, Lamau. If I spent, like, multiple years and 100,000 gold pieces to get my magic sword, and you say it's cursed by a god, that better have long-standing plot significance. Like, that better affect my character and not just be a, your item gets, you get struck by lightning, Lamau. I better be able to remove the curse. I better be able to do something. It needs, and I think that that's kind of implied. But you need to have, like, complications should always have some kind of plot reason, right? And I don't know, this might be an unpopular opinion or whatever, but I randomness is great. People like playing old school games where you can just get screwed over by dice, whatever. I don't enjoy that, really. And if I were playing with the DM with these rules and he just rolled on the dice and it just said, the seller is murdered before the sale, you don't get the item. Your money's gone. Or you can't find it. You have to find another seller. I'd be like, you can't track down the murderer. Like, I want to do that kind of stuff. And I feel like that's probably implied, but they should have said, these complications can severely affect the game. You know, not if you want to make things more interesting for the characters. Like, more interesting kind of implies that, but I think if I'm writing this, just in case, I'm going to be explicit and say, if you're doing this, make sure that there's an overall plot reason for whatever complication you decide, right? And it can't just be something random, or it's gonna really feel like shit. Did anyone disagree with that?
It kind of depends on what situation and what complication, because there's some that I think are, they're not awful. But once again, it's one of those things that doesn't really need to be on a table. It's kind of like, this is all good for, you know, inspiration, but I think it's definitely one of those things you would want to leave up to the DM's discretion. You know, if there is actually a foil in play, you want a solid situation that revolves around what they're doing or some other event in town. I completely agree that there's some good opportunities with just, you know, oh, there's some cleric in town and he's trying to drum up business for his god of war or something, and he starts a fight club or something. Like, that's all right, but I think that
Well, what's the magic item specifically? Remember, we're talking about the magic
the
items.
magic
I'm
items,
gonna yell out all the other things
I'm
soon.
going through all that specifically because I think that with the magic items, once again, it's in the same vein. If you're a DM, it's better to kind of make those decisions yourself, actually think them through, and don't just go like, roll a d6. Your magic item kills
A
you.
12.
Roll a new character.
Exactly. Like, I think that some of the stuff on there, it's a lot more minor, but even with that, it's kind of like you should think it through before you just throw it at a character.
Yeah. Okay. So now we move on to carousing. Carousing is basically you get drunk and you fuck shit up. I can't complain about this because you're drunk as hell, so like the complications, they all make sense. I will say a pickpocket lifts 1d10 x10 GP from you. Stealing 100 gold pieces, like that's a pretty sizable bag. You know, like that would be very obvious to anyone around you.
You're
Other than that
really
though,
fucked up, man. You're St. Patty's Day in Boston fucked up.
well, no, but like someone else around you would be like, "Hey, that guy just got, you know, stole that stuff." The other thing is like surprised you're married or something. The thing is, this assumes that your character is just absolutely fucking trashed, right? Like just off their ass drunk, which is fine, but it also makes it kind of useless for like characters who are like moderate clerics who might go out and have a couple beers and have fun. You know, clerics can be cool. They're like the modern preachers who are hip and hop,
No, they
hippity
aren't.
hoppity, and they have the acoustic guitar, the white guy with the acoustic guitar that sings about how great Jesus is, and it makes me want to fucking stab my ears out. But you know, you have people like that, like they'll go out and have a couple drinks, but they won't streak or get married or like do something very, very illegal, which to me means like murder or like treason. You know, or like other things that are like completely horrible.
They open people's mail. They smash people's mailboxes.
And also, okay, this is like the most minor point in the entire universe. Sure, you were drunk when you agreed to fund the orphanage, but a contract is a contract. That's bullshit. If you're intoxicated, you can't legally make decisions for yourself, which includes signing contracts or and signing contracts of any kind, which I actually technically includes getting married, which was not necessarily true in medieval society. But you know, that is legally incorrect. You are not able to sign a contract while intoxicated. That is an invalid contract. You need to be of sound mind.
Super, there's two things here. First, you just showed why Puella Magi Maloca Magica doesn't work because minors can't sign contracts. Little cute bunny thing.
Oh,
Second,
yeah. The like evil guy that's like
a rabbit.
I need to sustain the universe on suffering, and then instead of just like going to Africa or like people who play Dota and just harvesting their suffering, he just tortures innocent Japanese school children for no fucking reason.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. But also, that's really deflected can be writing wise saying, that's cool, man. That works for America. This isn't America. This is
I know.
fucking medieval land times place. I'm great at naming things. And
That's
also, if your
just
setting isn't
a. First of
America,
all, if
your
it's
setting
medieval
is
times.
shit.
If it's medieval times, statistically, most of their locations are in North America or other Western countries. So, if you're in medieval times and you're drunk and you sign a contract, your character is likely in Anaheim, California. In which case, I think your character has other problems because they're like a real-life fantasy creature going to go see a medieval times show. Like, Maybe they fell through
a portal. Is it like the Ember Island players of, like, Avatar? It's like just a self-parody.
No, but I'm picturing that they walk out and they're just in the middle of fucking Anaheim. There's, like, cars and shit, and they're like, whoa, what's going on?
But
how drunk did I get?
You know what I meant? Like, if you're in, like, your setting is medieval.
I know.
If someone wants to say, like, oh, I was drunk, isn't that law? Like, laws are different here. Contract's a contract. Take it up. Yeah. Take it up with the government. The government says, did you sign the contract? Yes, too fucking bad. So it's, you are legally correct, but laws work differently.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And the other thing is there's a couple of, like, other things where it's like, eh. Like, and this is, like, super minor nitpicks, and it doesn't really matter. Let me be clear. I know that this is very nitpicky. But, like, if you get a 6 on the upper-class carousing complications, a boring noble insists you visit every day and listen to long, tedious theories of magic. I have a character who was, like, a magical researcher, and that was his whole life, and he'd be so down for that. Like, that would not be a complication. That'd be, like, a dream come true, you know? But it's like, eh. You know, whatever. And it is also weird, like, the variety of severity, which I get that that's probably the point, but it is kind of funny seeing you tripped and fell during a dance and people can't stop talking about it right next to you have agreed to take on a noble's debt. It's like, these are slightly greater severities. I don't know. What do you guys think of this table? Or Connor, you know, who hasn't complained about carousing.
I mean, I honestly don't have too much of an issue with it. Some of them I do agree are a bit too severe, but once again, it goes back to what I was saying before. It's just kind of, I don't think I would ever use any of this directly if I was to DM something. I would perhaps think it through and consider what sort of situations could develop out of, you know, one of the characters going and drinking, but I don't think that I would go with anything specifically like this, and I certainly wouldn't leave it up to a D10 to decide.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Then we have crafting an item, which I'm actually mostly okay with. The one thing I would say is that actually, crafting an item is fine price-wise, but the whole selling a magic item, and you can sell them for, like, way, way less than what you can buy them for, that's kind of like, what? And also, you have to spend money to seek people out, which is weird. Because, like, the other people have to spend money to seek you out. So, I don't know. But, I don't know. Crafting an item, I think that this is all pretty okay. I like it, you know? Would you guys agree with that? I can't say much, because I think it's pretty darn good.
Yeah, I think that the crafting looks fine. I honestly didn't even notice it was such a small section.
The one thing that's... okay, if we can get into crafting items and crafting magic items, I have a very big overall. It ties crafting a magic item with buying a magic item with selling a magic item. It's this overall thing, if I can make that now, because I guess now is a good time as ever. So, magic item. To make a legendary magic item, you need 100,000 gold, 500 work weeks. Alright, makes sense. Cool. To buy a magic item that is considered legendary, let me find it.
The average on that was 175,000.
Yeah, 2d6 times 25,000 GP, 175,000. All right, man's got to make a profit. Cool. Difference between that, it's about 75k. All right. Go to, and let me find selling an item, a magic item specifically, legendary. Base price, 25,000 GP, and if you roll a 21... or higher on the offer, you get 150% times it, right? So, that rolling that out is 375,000. Sell it. That's best possible. So,
It's not 25 times, isn't it? If you go to the... Oh, God, where I sell the magic item.
Yeah, no, it's... Sorry, it was 37K. My mistake. 37K for the best possible offer. You rolled the 30, right? So,
yeah,
100K to make it versus 175 to buy it. So to make and sell, your best possible... You lose money. If you want to make a magic item to sell, you lose money. And this is honestly just kind of a lore fluff nitpick. But the magic item economy is fucked to shit. The sunk cost is absolutely garbage. And you might be thinking, Andrew, why the fuck would I make a magic item just to sell it and flip it for a profit? And to that I say, fuck off. Lore is important.
No. It's because you got drunk and took on a noble's debt.
Yes, because you drunk. You got drunk. You took on a noble's debt. This is all you can do. You're absolutely desperate, which is why you're forging this demon blade. That explains everything, officer. Please don't burn me at the stake. And so I just have this whole thing of... You can't sell it. It's, again, just, like, it's all nitpicks, honestly. Like, the only... the only real legitimate criticism, like, the full-on criticism of, hey, this is unbalanced, that we have here, comes from the stats thing that you're going to talk about in a bit.
Yeah. Well, no, I have a criticism of this, because it would make sense if you couldn't just buy magic items and sell them at a profit, or make them and sell them at a profit, because you're not experienced in doing that, that's not your whole life, and you're not, like, a professional merchant that has all the connections and, like, knows how to, you know, drip the, you know, you're a pretty untrustworthy guy, because you're, like, some fucking murder hobo somewhere. So it makes sense that people wouldn't be willing to pay so much. But literally, like, a third of the cost? That's, like, way, way too little. It should have been, like, you can make a piddling profit if you make it yourself. And if you buy it and try to resell it, you have, like, a decent loss, like a 20k gold loss or something. Like, such extreme losses to me are just not really... It doesn't make sense in-universe, like, at all, right? Because there are things that you can only sell for a loss, but there's very few things where you have to sell for such a ridiculous loss that aren't shit like... hats, right? You peel a sticker off the baseball hat or whatever and it loses money. I don't know if that's still true. That used to be true. Or like Yeezys. You know, used Yeezys are gonna not go for nearly as much as new Yeezys.
I don't know what you're talking about. They're still all $900 on eBay. But basically, and sorry to just cut off the criticism here. It's basically like...
For cars is a better example.
You can
used
just,
cars are way
you
cheaper
can fix
than
the price. You can... you can fix the price and go to jail. But like, the DM can affect the price here. And it kind of goes into the whole nitpicky thing of, it's just a lot of this is up to the DM's discretion, the disparity, the what happened, the complications, everything is just, this is a springboard, fixed, it's totally your discretion, which is the whole point of Unearthed Arcana. Here's an idea, try it out.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So then we have, So gambling, right? Gambling, I didn't actually do the math on. I will do the math on at some point. But my intuition says that if you have, like, a multi-class, you could really abuse this. My intuition says I would have to do the stats, because actually the plus accrued debt equal to that amount. I feel like maybe that makes it balanced or whatever, because as it turns out, 5 plus 2d10 is actually very hard to beat. And we're going to talk about that now. Okay, so pit fighting. Wait, really quickly first, Stouter. Magical items. We've got to do
no
that.
No comments.
Stouter is Connor 2. It's the same name for different people. Or
you
different
skipped
names
crime.
For the same person.
I'm so upset.
Oh my god, crime. Well, first magic
crime
items.
Crime is the best fucking part.
Magic items.
Very few comments. I think the fact that you just somehow craft a legendary item is a bit weird, but besides that.
I make the Holy Sword of Excalibur. You sell it for a penance. Good job.
Yeah, from,
England
fucking,
is ruined.
From chopsticks and gum. You have to make your own Lady of the Lake,
you
too.
You fold the gum 1,000 times. Congratulations. It's the Holy Sword Excalibur. Use it to save Britannia.
Okay, crime. What do you think about crime, Stouter? I thought crime was a great area. I thought crime was A-okay.
Do you
disagree?
I just wanted it
crime
to be
is
included.
A-okay. What a quote.
I like crime. It has. I am a fan of crime. Yay, crime. It has. I'm going to run for president. This is going to be on every fucking ad.
I like the last one on this list. That's your victim has a heart of gold, and everyone in town is now looking for you, the thieving scumbag. And it has a little asterisk next to it. Like, yeah, that could involve your foil. And it's just like...
I like that your foil is like a nice person.
Yeah, crime is illegal, so it's not lawful. And, you know, you're kind of screwing someone over, so it could head into the non-good territory, like neutral, evil territory, just into the evil territory. So it obviously doesn't work if your campaign is supposed to be people who are good, unless you're doing a whole Robin Hood shtick. And it doesn't work if you're doing, you know, a lawful campaign. So, you know, as a foil, and then kind of going back to the whole foil thing, your foil could be the good guy, and you could just all be assholes.
Okay, moving on to pit fighting. This is where it gets pretty bullshit. So the way the rules for pit fighting work, okay? You roll Strength Athletics, Dexterity Acrobatics, and Wisdom Insight with a randomly generated DC, and depending on the number of successes, you gain or lose a certain amount of money. First of all, it requires 1 work week of effort to pit fight. I think that's a little, like, meh. Like, for me, this is like a night. You go join the fight club, you beat the shit out of somebody, you blow up a building, it turns out that it's all a metaphor for, you know, not... being too masculine or whatever.
Chuck Palahniuk, you madman.
Okay, here's the problem I have with this. I did some statistics. I wrote a Ruby gem, and I'm rewriting it in C++, so it's faster, because on very hard statistical analysis, it's quite slow. But I wrote a program that does statistics on dice, and it does exact statistics. It's very powerful, so it lets me get stuff like, what are the chances of someone getting a certain number of failures or successes? So I did this for a couple characters in my campaign. First up, we have Iskander. He's a level 10 fighter. He has 20 strength. His chances are as follows. He has a 16.68% chance to just wholesale fail and make no money at all. Remember, this guy is like the peak of human strength. He's like insane.
He's a scary
wholesale chance to just fail. And his wisdom doesn't suck either. He has a +1 to wiz. So he has a 16.68% chance to just be fucking awful. Okay. A 43.449 chance to win one fight and gain 50 gold. One fight, 10 strength, 44% chance. The greatest chance is he just wins once. And then he has a 32.5% chance to win twice. Remember, this guy is like 6'8". He's like more muscled than Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's insane. So he wins twice and he gets 100 GP. And his chance of winning three times are only 7%. So he has a greater chance of just failing completely than being extremely successful at fighting when he is a fighter, trained in fighting, and he has 20 strength. Okay, so that's a little weird to me. So I checked out the monk. The monk had a 9% chance to fail outright. It makes sense. Monk's a little better at hand-to-hand combat. Okay, I can accept it fine. And then he has 30% chance to get one success. And I'm like, wait a minute, hold on. He's a monk. He fights hand-to-hand. That's like his whole thing. He has all these key points. He has all the shit he can do. Why is this so low? And then a 40% chance to get two successes. You know, that makes sense. And a 13.91% chance to get three successes. Okay, that's pretty good. Right, that, you know, that makes a little more sense. But again, if you're in a world where class levels are rare or something, you're gonna not win. Like, if you're mostly up against like regular everyday people, you're gonna wipe the floor with them. So you're assuming that this is a pit fight where someone who could single-handedly beat a level 10 monk with 20 dexterity and 13 strength too in hand-to-hand combat. Like, where are all these people? Why are they just doing that when they could be, you know, looting dungeons and stuff? I get that that's more dangerous, but, like, it seems a little weird that the random boxers are this powerful in a random town.
It's their wax mustaches that give them their power.
Now, due to the way this works, having expertise in, like, anything makes you extremely good at this. And the rogue didn't have any expertise in any of the stats, but he did have a +2 to dex from a magic item. So he kind of wiped the floor with everybody. He had a 7% chance to just fail, 35% chance to have one success, a 42% chance to have two successes, and a 14.8% chance to have three successes. Okay, and here's... Exactly. And that's fine, because whatever. I still think that the three successes should probably be way higher. He's level 10. He can, you know, uncanny dodge, bullshit, whatever. And I know, I'm going to, before you're like, Anthony, you're an idiot, it's for balance reasons. I'm going to get into that later, I understand that. Here's the problem. For a shitty level 1 peasant that has a 10 in every stat and works the plows all day and is not remarkable or special in any way, and these guys are sacrificed by the thousands by lizard folk and kobolds or eaten by dragons. Like, these people die like flies in the average D&D setting, right? They just get fucked over immediately. Has a 40.5% chance to fail. Now that seems like, okay, that's a pretty high number to just do at nothing. This is a random-ass person thrown into a fight club. If you threw me into a fight club, I'd get my ass beat. If you threw the average random Joe into a fight club, who's the average random guy who's just late for work, Okay, you kidnap him and you throw him into a fight club. He's going to get wrecked 95% of the time. Fighting is very hard. It's a specialized skill. And the difference between their chance to fail and the, you know, level 20 fighter with 20 strength should not be, like, 24%. That should not be the difference in percentages. It should be way, way higher. Okay, here's where it gets really bullshit. They have a higher chance, a 42.7% chance, to succeed once. So they actually have a higher chance of winning than failing. So this is a fight club where the average fighter is worse than average. So that makes no sense at all. So this is a fight club where the average person is worse at fighting than any random person taken off the street. And yet there are enough people in this club who are better at fighting that they can easily take down a level 20 or a level 10, 20 strength fighter. Okay, that does not make any sense. And then they have a 15% chance to win twice. So that means that they can win two bouts. 15% is way too high if this is like a professional fighting ring. And they have a 1.57% chance for three, which I would also argue is too high. Now the reason for this, okay, the reason for this is because it'd be way too OP if you could just spend a week and become king of the fights by getting 200 gold and over and over consistently, which is what would make sense. And because they want other people to have a chance to go in the fight club and, like, maybe win something, okay? However, this needs to be statistically modified in some way, probably by making the DC way less random. Make it be 15 plus 1d10, probably, okay? So that a peasant will consistently lose almost 90% of the time, and player characters will at least win once almost 90% of the time. And that is true in some cases, but a level 10 fighter with 20 strength should never have a 16% chance. That should be a 10% chance, maybe 5% chance at most, probably. In my opinion, at least.
Right.
Just from, like, a balanced standpoint, right?
Like,
You have the problem of, like, well, then how do we, Anthony, how do you prevent players from just going and getting 200 gold over and over and over again? Someone notices that this guy is winning literally every fight, and all of a sudden the challenges maybe get harder. And you can make the statistics up as a DM. The challenges suddenly get a lot harder because this guy is, like, the ultimate, and you can win a shitload of money by beating him. Alternatively, they just kick him out of the club because he's too good. Alternatively, you introduce some kind of plot thing so that they have to go away. I feel like making it just the most swingy thing ever in order to try to balance it is really boring, unrealistic, and it's like, it kind of cheapens the whole thing of, like, I'm going to get into a cage fight with my super cool, powerful character. If you do that, then your character should be, like, super cool and powerful unless there's, like, one other guy in the fight club that's, like, thematic or whatever. Personally, I would not do this unless it was, like, hand-to-hand combat. You go until you're unconscious or whatever, right? I would roll this out as a fight. I know that this is supposed to be just downtime and it's, like, just stuff to do in the background. But from a narrative perspective, the way the statistics play out makes almost zero sense.
Well,
and that's my piece.
Well, you see, Anthony, the reason you were wrong is because you want to have a narrative in your game, and that is wrong. That was a joke.
You're just
rolling
dice.
And obviously, like as you've proven, just wholesale statistically, it's not balanced at all. It's kind of fucked. You can hand wave that away as a DM. Like, if your players run the stats and say, "Hey, this is fucked up," you can hand wave that away as a DM and just say, "Oh, you find people who are fair. You're not going to go pick on the local farm fight club. You're going to go fight, like, a fighter's guild. You're going to go fight the boxing guild, the people who do this shit for a living, so that it's a quote-unquote fair fight, so that these stats make more sense." But even then, that's the DM coming up with a reason to make this work. And that's kind of happened for all the other stuff in this Unearthed Arcana, but that stuff's all, like, narrative. That's all, like, plot hooks. That's all, you know, this is, like, doing this activity in and of itself. You have to come up with a reason for why it can work. Like, statistically, mathematically.
I don't like that you need to be all good at all three of them either. Because that creates a problem where it's, like, it's good to have insight. You can win a fight by just reading your opponents and being good like that or whatever. That shouldn't be required. You should be able to just pummel the shit out of somebody, right? Like, I feel like the system they have is mechanically, like, doable, Because, like, something that's more complicated and it's, like, if you get a crit fail on your insight roll, then you, you know, whatever, right? Like, that would suck. That'd be way harder. But it does lead to this kind of thing where it's, like, the best character to be a pit fighter isn't the giant hulking guy that's going to punch people and is, like, pretty dexterous and well-trained. They also need to be really wise, you know? They also need to be, like, a monk.
You see, like, your failure was that you didn't just play Bruce Lee.
Ugh.
And that is where you went wrong.
I think I went wrong when I was born, actually. Connor, what do you think?
I think that, like, if... assuming that these statistics are completely accurate, it makes no sense that... like, this is based off of our characters, and just thinking about the campaign... like, that's completely ridiculous. My character in combat is entirely reliant on the existence of other people in the party. Like, rogues, in 5th edition especially, at least if you're playing the thief archetype like I am, you really don't have a whole lot of damage of your own. You have sneak attack, which is induced by one of your allies being near the person. And, you know, in a pit fight setting, you know, you're assuming this is like a one-on-one thing. My character would suck. There's no reason that I would have a higher success rate than, like, especially a monk and a fighter. That's completely unsensible, in my opinion. Just based on, like, how the game normally plays out, that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. I agree that every one of the characters, you know, if they're going up against just, like, peasants or whatever, yeah, fine, but... on the other hand, if you're assuming that we're going up against people that are more the type that our characters would have to take on during an adventure, it would... it just doesn't really make sense to me, I guess.
That you do better than them. I think that you should do fairly well just because of Uncanny Dodge and that kind of thing. However, you definitely shouldn't be doing better than the fighter that can just, like, punch somebody across the room. You shouldn't be doing better than the monk that primarily fights with a freaking staff and punching people. Yeah. His punches probably wind up doing more damage in the long run than a staff, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty much my point with it. I do agree, it's... the statistics for the peasant are a bit absurd, you know? It's always the one success one that I like looking through, because that's the one that everybody's closest in, which seems stupid. Mm-hmm. Just like some hot dog vendor in the stadium just walks down onto the field and wins a fist fight with someone.
Deep down, that hot dog vendor was secretly the chosen one this whole time.
Yeah, so I agree. I think the statistics are definitely messed up, and it probably wouldn't take too much to fix it to an extent anyways. Granted, my character wouldn't go and punch people, so... it's hard to wrap my mind around.
Yeah. Okay, and now we get to religious service. I'm gonna yell about this. Oh, we have relaxation. I like relaxation. I like that there's no complication table, because relaxation rarely comes with complications.
There should be a
That's great.
There should be a complication table that's just like a D100 and just like all this awful stuff.
I was really happy that it wasn't you're too sedative and you get heart disease, you develop a blood clot from lack of movement, you have a brain aneurysm and die, you know?
Your spa day ends with a happy ending you didn't plan on, everyone now judges you as a degenerate. Deal with it. Ugh. Relaxation was the best possible thing you should always do in your free time. Just do nothing.
The thing is, though, it says that you have to have the funds to support that, and, you know, it requires a modest lifestyle.
I mean, the average adventurer has shitloads of cash to spend, so it doesn't...
I get that, but I'm saying, like, it isn't just completely without cost. I just figure that it would... like, if you're looking at this table and you're like, oh, I definitely want my characters to do this sort of stuff, and, you know, I'll give them a bunch of options for stuff they can do, like, during a couple of weeks that they aren't out adventuring. Like, I guess I personally, if I was a DM, I would definitely want to see the players going with one of the other options, just because they're more interesting and they have the potential to lead to interesting things. If nothing else, it's, you know, the characters are at least being active in that time. But, again, that's player choice. And that's just my thoughts on it, I guess.
It's kind of like, this is like, I think it's because we all, or at least Anthony and I, have both tried to make campaigns that have some sort of overarching story. So we have a plan of, like, what we want to do. This is more for, like, I think this works better if you just have a very improv-y, like, this will make a hook. And if you just want to randomize a plot hook to just get going and just improv shit. All these on Earth Arcana, like, with the complications, if you just want to improv, like, a whole session, here's something that can give you an idea. He's like, oh, you're old? Okay, well, you know, like, kind of goes back to the whole, surprise, you're married, now you have to deal with that. Or, oh, your secret weapon, the guy who made it got killed, and now the person who killed him has it. Go track down that guy to get the weapon. Etc., etc.
Yeah.
So it's just plot, like, a lot of these, especially with the complications, it's just plot hooks, so relaxation obviously differs in that sense of, you just kind of pass. Like, do you want the random plot hook thing? No, just pass. It lets you, like, heal stuff. Or maybe it's similar to, you know, the Hotel Motel 6 adventure you had in Anthony's last campaign, where everyone else, you know, lived in the penthouse where you just assumed, oh, you're going to get murdered there. And then, lo and behold, the small child with the knife is in your room.
He wasn't a small child, he was 18.
The boy with the person with the knife is in your room.
Yeah.
So it just kind of... But basically what I'm saying is relaxation, you should have a 1d100 chance of actually just dying. Wholesale dying, no death saves, roll up a new character, GG, well played, dice is a bitch like that.
Classic, the classic DM stuff. Religious service, I kind of like this. The one thing I don't like, though, is Oh no, this is fine, actually. Right, the temple elders implore you to take a holy quest. They just implore you. I'm cool with that. That's cool. I'm fine with it. But, I mean, overall, actually, religious service is pretty good. It's pretty good because it's, like, all the stuff is, like, realistically stuff outside your control on the complications table. It doesn't cost money to be a priest. And I'm playing a cleric as, like, my second PC ever. And I really do like roleplay opportunities to play, like, a holy person and not just a battle medic. That's why I really, really love the, ceremony ritual that's, like, super legit. And I'm super glad that's in there. And I hope one of the player characters' motivations is apparently just to get married. And I hope that I get to marry them at some point, because that would make me feel like I'm actually playing someone besides a healbot, you know. And I like the idea that you can go and actually help out in the temple for a week. And it's, like, nice. You know, I like it. It's a good RP thing. Any objections?
Well, did you discuss some of the complications in there yet?
Yeah, they all seem like there's something that's, like, outside of the, like, outside of your control. It doesn't say that you do something. Except for the one. You have offended a priest for your words or actions. That, I feel like that should be, like, a charisma check. Or something.
I don't know, I think some of them are just kind of weird. Like
what? Number two is pretty bad, too, actually.
The one that I was thinking of mostly is number four. Like, just from a realism perspective, why would you ask this, like, dumpy-looking guy who just walks in, like, hey, wanna be a spy for us? Like, I guess, if you're thinking about a fantasy setting, it kind of makes sense. Like, oh, he's the new guy, he'll be more susceptible to that sort of thing. But on the other hand, if you're talking, like, a real setting, do you commonly watch somebody walk into a church in your town and say, like, oh, they're the new guy, let's see what's going on in there?
Yeah, well, the other thing is, like, you're a cleric, and you like, derive your powers from worshipping a certain deity, and the guy comes to you, and he's like, hey, you want to be trained deity and spy for me,
like,
fam?
And you're like, what? It's something about the setting, and just something about, like, would people really do that? I don't know.
Maybe I could the other be completely sect is, wrong. Like, a legit insane cult, and they just don't know what's going on. Maybe they're just idiots.
I mean, the player's manual, when talking about the assassin archetype specifically, it says something about, like, oh, you could be, like, a religious spy or something, like, kind of acting as, like, an agent for one specific religion and go and do whatever needs to be done for your god, but I don't know, I still think it's just kind of strange, especially given that, you know, if you're considering this to be downtime, just players walking into a town, and then they're just like, oh, we'll relax here for a few days. Would you really trust the guy who just walked off the street, his boots caked in blood? I don't know. Seems like you would want to go with anyone else.
Friendly neighborhood murder hobo.
Yeah, the research thing is, like, meh. The one problem, the biggest problem I have with research, is that if you get an 8 on the if you get, where is it? Oh my god, please. You get an 8, a 6 on the complications table, it says, you uncovered useful lore, but only by promising to complete a dangerous task in return. It's like, I as a player don't get a choice. I was just like, yeah, I really need to know that the vampire is weak to sunlight, so I'm gonna go and kill the ancient red dragon now. Thanks. You know? I prefer it. All the other ones are like, you accidentally damage a rare book. Okay, it's just something that happens. You offend a sage. Okay, sage is just an idiot. If you had known that book was cursed, you would never have opened it. Well, you know, you didn't know it was cursed, so you opened it. Same strange theories and reality becomes obsessed with convincing you. Oh god, Alex Jones is your best friend. Your actions cause you to be banned from a library until you make reparations. Oh, well, looks like that bitch librarian Glinda was yelling at you. I don't know. But number 6 is kind of like, oh yeah, you did this. It's your fault. And it's entirely in your control because you promised to do this. And I'm kind of like down on that. I don't like it as much. I don't know. I like the idea behind research, but that particular complication is kind of meh. As well as the idea that you have to spend a whole bunch of money to get, like, 3 pieces of lore. And they have the vague lore thing, which is, like, I don't think, as a DM, I would be like, nah. You can't just be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna save up some lore points in case I need to know something. You know?
Sorry, you go.
All that I wanted to say about it is, I think that it's kind of weird to abstract the results of research into just, like, you gain a piece of lore. Like, it's kind of weird. I don't know how you would fit that into some settings. Like, would you actually just say something like a random fact about monsters or something stupid like that? Because with some settings, that's kind of putting the DM on the spot. Like, what do I tell this person?
It also has a realism problem, because it's like, are you really going to find a book that's going to tell you a pit fiend is resistant to fire, and then nothing else about a pit fiend? You know?
Like, okay, I actually have something here, and I'm going to avoid spoilers, because I actually have some stuff on this, but, like, I think of it more like, it gives you a chance to flesh out your setting if you're kind of, like, doing your setting differently, right? Like, not, like, totally breaking, like, throwing out the D&D lore and everything, but, like, say, you know, for mine, like, just an example, gods, you know, everyone has their religion, but, like, unlike yours, Anthony, the gods, like, don't manifest, which you're a cleric and all have to come up with a reason for why you can literally talk to your god eventually, but, like, if you could, like, speak to them, that's, like, a major religious miracle. That's, like, they read a book in the holy book about you and that happening. It's huge. Versus, mm-hmm. you know, in your setting where it's like, you know, last week we played poker at Colonel Mac's bar, for like 6 hours.
Well, that's because he's Colonel Mac, though. He's pretty shitty. He's the god of kobolds.
And then we just like fucked her. We prank called Lull a few times. And here's the thing, yeah, I'm lying, kind of. But this could all work in your setting. And so, like, so it was like, oh, I'm gonna go to the library and do research, and you read a book about, you know, different religions, and that gives the DM a chance to explain something. Or say, like, a different book about a certain thing they want to give detail to, or a certain, like, lore thing. Like, you know, for example, say, like, you're at the library, like, oh, I'm gonna read a book. I'm like, okay, roll a d6. And you pull, like, a 3. I'm like, okay, you find a book on the history of, you know, the guild that you're in, the Brynhildr Guild. And so then I would just talk about, you know, how that was started, who was Brynhildr and what she was, and just what it, just give a whole, like, expository about that. It's basic. I think the benefit of this, at least to a DM, is exposition time. It gives you exposition, like, a way to give it without it being forced because, you know, there's a story reason the player wanted to go to the library and read about it.
But yeah, but then your player has to spend 100 gold to get exposition debt. Like,
he asked for it. He went to the library. He knew what would happen. He had it coming. They had it coming. All of them, all of you have it coming. God won't stop me in my unending quest to just exposit people. That's all I had to say.
I like it. Okay. Moving right along after that, after research, scribing a spell scroll. I'm disappointed that you can't write cursed or genocide spells on cursed scrolls and summon 1300 or whatever krakens and just become max level immediately. But that was a NetHack reference. For the record, if you enjoy really traditional, old school, entirely role style RPGs and you're like foaming at the mouth and only listening because of anger, because like how dare they say that you have to have narrative stuff instead of rolling on a table, stop playing D&D and play NetHack. You'll probably have a lot more fun because NetHack is exactly like that. It's amazing. I love NetHack. It's a very good game.
And if you've never played NetHack before, here's the trick. You turn around, climb up the ladder, and leave the dungeon.
That is one.
That's how you win.
Yeah. Oh, and the tourist is the best class. Does anyone else have problems, or does any, not anyone else, because I think this is fine, have
yes.
problems with, I do like how a level 9 spell is, like, 96 worksheets. It's like a little novella.
I just like to imagine this wizard just sitting there painstakingly with a quill, just like, gotta get it just right. Or do you think that it's just, like, he's tried it so many times, like, there's just a giant thing of paper, like, stacked on top of the trash can in the corner?
There's, like, just X, like, the actual spell is, like, 4 sentences, and there's just so many provisions.
It's like a single page, but all the other pages, like, he's gone through, like, oh, it's gotta be super long, so he writes, like, Tolstoy's War and Peace. He's
so
like, oh, wait, it's
problem,
4 lines.
Though? Okay, so here's the problem, though, from, like, a perspective outside of everything. One of the complications is, due to a strange error in creating the scroll, it is instead a random spell of the same level. So does that mean that in the 96 pages, if you change, like, one letter, all of a sudden, instead of wish, you have true polymorph? And, like, the rest are all the same? How does that work? I think that's amusing. I like that, actually.
Don't a couple of the power word... a couple of the power word spells fall into that?
Yeah.
Such as what?
I mean, but why would you ever get a power word spell? They're all awful.
Power word kill.
Well, yeah, but I'm just
dead.
Saying, like...
It's
what
awful.
If, what if
That's
you're...
Just charismatic wall them.
What if you're trying to make, like... Let's say that you are trying to make, like... Wish, and then you just accidentally make power word kill.
I hope you wish for someone to die.
I'm just saying, like, you're sitting there over the body of your dead friend, and you're like, please, let him get back up, and then just shoots a bolt of lightning into his face, and he just explodes. He's definitely dead.
Well, no, but it seems like you know that it happened. It seems like you, like, read over it, and you're like, oh, what the way? Power kill!
I wrote, it's like, I have a few friends who are learning Japanese. It's like where if you draw a kanji a certain way, it can mean one thing,
But if you draw the line slightly differently, it means a completely different, totally unrelated word.
Which I'm hoping that the words are often highly offensive.
Better yet...
Like, you can either say, like, mother or bitch.
Better yet, I just checked, and power word heal and power word kill are both level 9.
So, yeah. That's a gamble there.
So long, the magic item we kind of talked about already.
The magic item economy's fucked to shit. The prices need to be fixed. I do like,
Arrival circulates rumors that the item is fake. Yeah, your giant-ass wand that can shoot fireballs, that's totes fake.
My sword that can kill a god. Whatever, man. You know what? I'll keep it for myself.
And when
Bane comes and kills you all, I'll be laughing.
The other thing that's amazing, like, the buyer's sinister reputation makes it clear that the item will be used to commit evil. Okay, don't sell it to them, that's fine. The item is a lost relic belonging to a holy order. What if you made it, and then they just suddenly come to you, and they're like, that is the holy grail, and you're like, I made this. No, it was used by Jesus 2,000 years ago. But
this is just
I literally
a cup
just
that
made this like, last week.
This is just the cup that tells you what liquid's in it.
I like training. Training is kind of neat. I really wish the train could give you weapon proficiencies with just one weapon. Because holy shit, I want to be proficient in something that isn't a dagger as a cleric. And that is a dex weapon.
Transcender disappears. I haven't read these yet.
Yeah, no,
they're
great.
That'd be my luck. I just keep rolling one over and over and over. Next time a real session happens, just walk into the house. There's just, like, dozens of dead bodies. Oh, there's Mr. Jacobs.
Your instructor teaches you a rare archaic methods. You were trying to learn fist fighting, and it teaches you drunken fist.
Yeah, that's great. I just imagine that,
I fucking care.
You teach him, like, performance with, like, a horn or something, and you, like, pull out, like, an old school, like, without any valves or anything, and you just do it entirely with armature, and people are just like, buddy? What? I don't even know. Well, no, like, your teacher's a cruel taskmaster. That doesn't affect you at all. He's just a dick. Congrats. And it happened... It's not like you have to, like, listen to some guy berate you over and over. It happened during downtime. Someone was a dick to you during downtime, but it ultimately had no consequences.
And you know what?
Back to D&D.
Maybe your character needs some hard discipline. They just need a structured, very non-lenient environment like that. Maybe that's how they learn well. Work. Yes. Okay, no, can I have the first word on work? May I? I take your silence as a yes. So, work. Because when I play a game, I want to simulate fucking work. Because that's what I love. I love simulating the tedious work of life. It's not like I have work to do at school. It's not like I'm going to have to get a job and do fucking work there. Nah, man. On my weekends, when I am pal around with all my friends, half drunk, I want to do more work.
I think you've only ever played D&D half drunk with us once.
A solid 3 or 4 times, actually.
I have never played D&D while intoxicated. Nor have I ever really been that intoxicated. Hashtag straight edge. Just kidding. That was a joke. Please stop. Stop. No. Don't swipe to the right. No. Stop. Okay. We're good. You don't need to hit the red delete button. I promise. Just swipe it back. Turn off your iPod. Thank you. Or don't turn it off. Turn off the home screen. Put it back in your pocket. Continue jogging. Awesome. Yeah, I don't know. I'm fine with work. I do like how, like, the local crime ring targets your business for a shakedown. If you're a level 10 wizard, that's a great way to get the whole crime ring murdered. Like, you just fireball them. They come into your shop like, hey, something bad could happen to you. And you're like, yeah, well, maybe you guys want to pay protection. You never know when a crazy wizard's going to set you on fire. You know, that'd be fun.
I love how your employer could just be involved with the Dark Cult. I'm pretty sure I had managers like that. When I was working retail.
Vlad. Remember Vlad? I worked in the same place as him at a different time. Vladimir was definitely involved in a dark cult.
Positive. There's no doubt.
Guys, my one of my managers at Safeway, TM Safeway Co. registered trademark name used under fair use. Actually, like, went to prison, like, after I left, like, a few months after I left. So,
what the fuck? Why?
Like, some sort of, like, money shit. I don't know. But yeah, so She thought I was cool. She's like, you know, Andrew, you're a good worker. You get your job done and you don't fucking talk back. Good work. I'm like, thanks. Just keep sending me to clean the bathrooms instead of push carts in the hot sun. But yeah, so yeah, they're in, I think they committed a felony, so maybe it was a dark cult. Who knows? That's all close I learned enough about it. Wayfair. It's a grocery store run by Safeway. Crazy people.
You're allowed to say Safeway.
It's run by crazy people. Anyway, work. Fuck it. Fuck it. Fuck work.
Gonna go with I play D&D.
I'm gonna go in fucking... No, I'm gonna go into dungeons and kill dragons.
That's a good point. Why would the average peasant not just always be in a fight club? Wait a minute.
That was the point.
This is
of the
a problem.
But thank you very much, Chuck Palahniuk. I'm butchering the man's name, but that was... There you go. Violence is the answer.
I'm pretty
masculinity
sure
is toxic and destructive. Be in my movie, Brad Pitt. I've never read the song. Book.
I think... I don't know. Okay. Overall, Unearthed Arcana on downtime. I think the problem is I don't think... Really, Andrew went off on a rant on how downtime sucks. I talked about how I don't like downtime. Stouter, how do you feel about rolling things for downtime?
I think that rolling is really dumb. I think, as I said before, it should be more up to the DM's discretion. I think that the overall idea is good, though.
Yeah. Overall, decent UA. Meh. Like, meh. I don't know.
It's useful for the kind of players we are not. And the kind of DMs we are not. Like, the only reason I would use this is just kind of a, okay, major arc ended. There was a bit of a time skip, like, a you know, about a month. What were you doing in that month?
Yeah,
that's exactly. Like the only reason I've just come up with. Everything else, if I tried this in a campaign, if I at the end of the campaign, I always ask, something good, something bad, something ugly about it. You all would say, oh yeah, you know, the combat was great, you know, the characters are so good, Andrew, you're such an amazing writer and game designer. But yeah, that downtime part at the beginning was just kind of boring. You should have just cut that. And I would have been like, yeah. So it's just...
Cut it.
If you're the kind of player who you're just like, I just want random plot hooks, I just want to do random shit, I don't care about an overarching narrative, my character is just someone who just adventures for the love of adventuring, I don't want a big overarching story.
It's the game for you.
It's this for you. Everything else about this is just kind of meh. It just isn't for me. The only useful thing was the foil, which, you know, I already know how to write a foil character. Or I think I do, I'm just a hack.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay, Stouter, any final comments? Stouter/Connor. We're going to get used to that eventually.
Yeah. I have an additional comment on as general, but never mind. Put it last.
Nothing much more from me. I mean, again, this is all stuff that's much more pertinent to DMs than it is to me, so...
May I give my last thought, or, sorry?
Yep.
Connor, did I cut you off? Or, Connor, sorry, did I cut you off? Okay. So, and during this whole podcast, I came up with this really good metaphor. D&D is like jazz. You can improv some really cool stuff with it, and you can just work so serendipitously. And I think that serendipity for stuff is a really cool thing. Like in video games, when, like, you kill the final boss, and it's perfectly in time with the music, and it was just this completely random chance thing, it's just so great. So memorable, it's so amazing. And I think D&D is like that, it's like improvising it. It's like improvising a solo in jazz. But the thing is, you need, and this is kind of goes back to our whole like rant I went on earlier, you need to be in the right key, or the right mode, or whatever, you need a plan. I think, and what this sort of thing is, I think the whole improv thing, the whole completely, what's the plan for tonight? I don't fucking know. Here's a bunch of hooks, we'll see what happens. Sort of style of it, and I'm probably oversimplifying the kind of people who play like that. Just doesn't work for me, because I think something greater can come if you have a plan to a degree.
Anyway, that's probably the end of our show for tonight. We're going to end on that nice little metaphor. If you have any questions about D&D, things you want us to argue about, things you would like us to discuss, which will probably devolve into arguing, problems in your games, questions, whatever, you can message us on Twitter or tweet at us. I am @AnthonySuper1.
I'm at meme genre, follow for dank anime and bad politics. Oh wait, no, bad anime and dank politics.
You can follow me for bad politics and no anime, which is the best anime. You can also email me specifically at anthony@noided.media. That's anthony@noided.media. Not that anyone ever uses email. This isn't the 90s. In fact, repeating out my email and spelling it makes me think that I'm in some kind of, like, infomercial that's gonna scam a grandma into losing her house. But that is anthony@noided.media. Yeah, Twitter's probably a better way to contact us, honestly. Yeah, so hopefully you've enjoyed this. We're gonna try to do episodes, probably once every 2 weeks. Maybe a little earlier if we get more content, which would only happen if you guys talk to us. You know, and any comments or criticisms, how we can improve or whatever, would also be highly appreciated. So, for rolling into the DMs, I'm Anthony.
I'm Andrew. D&D is a bad game. Give us money so we can all drop out of school and do this full time.
That's not the goal. I mean, that'd be great, but we're not gonna e-beg, don't worry. And our last but not least...
I'm Connor. Goodbye.
Thanks!